And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper, unfortunately recovering from severe back injury, and we wish him very well and hope to have him back soon. Well, today we turn our focus to Palm Beach County as the economy takes an upward turn once more and construction starts to boom. Growth in western Palm Beach County seems inevitable. What lessons, if any, can be learned from the experiences of westward expansion in Miami-Dade and Broward counties? Joining us now is journalist Tony Doris in his last 10 years at the Palm Beach Post. Tony's worn a lot of hats. He's had a front row seat through the transition from a print-first to digital-first newsroom, and he currently covers municipal and government issues in Palm Beach Gardens, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
Really great, and great to be with you again, and I wish Joe were able to be with us.
Hello out there, Joe, wherever you are.
Yeah. Well, let's begin with what I just mentioned, this hot-button issue of growth management in Palm Beach County. What is going on there? Give us an overview.
Well, Palm Beach Gardens in particular is a fairly wealthy area, and Palm Beach Gardens and just south of it, there are some areas out west where development stalled. You know, that whole westward sprawl thing stopped when the economy stopped. But now there's money coming out of everywhere. There's opportunity, and so there are big pieces of land that are within the urban development boundary that are just ripe for development. Thousands upon thousands of homes are looking for permission to be built right now.
So they want to keep the boundaries. Do they want to change the zoning within the boundaries?
Exactly. There's one site right now. It was a ranch for decades upon decades, and it's 7,600 acres.
A single ranch.
A single ranch. It was called Vavis Ranch. And, you know, because it was a ranch, you know, the zoning was, it was allowed that they could build 400 homes there if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. But now it's not a ranch anymore, and the new owners built it with the idea, well, their first proposal, and these are Miami-based developers, by the way, and good ones, and ambitious ones, their first idea was to put 7,600 homes there. And everybody, including the city council, said, you know, no way. The traffic would be appalling for everybody who lives to the east of there. And it's kind of interesting. Similar issues that happened in Miami-Dade. And I remember Broward County when it got built out immediately after Hurricane Andrew, and what happens with the traffic.
Right.
People don't want the roads expanded, the people who already live there, because they know that will mean even more development out west. And yet if these people are allowed to build out west, they're going to need bigger roads. It's just a dilemma.
So where do the politicians stand?
Right now, you can call it a negotiation. These people can't develop their massive development without permission of the city council in Palm Beach Gardens. So they're trying to win them over, but the numbers keep coming down. They're not even saying how many homes they're proposing to build now, but they've cut out the whole northern part of their development. They'll just stick with the southern part of it. So maybe that cuts the number of homes down from, you know, 7,600 to 4,000 something, but they're not willing to talk about numbers yet. But that's what happens. They have to win over the hearts and minds of the residents, and that in turn eases the concerns of the politicians. And that's exactly what's happening. We'll see what number they arrive at.
What are the residents doing? Do they have any grassroots movements? I mean, are they totally against this? Are they speaking out?
It's interesting. I went to a bunch of meetings, which the developer sponsored, and to supposedly gather input. Other people said, oh, it's not input. They're just trying to sell us on
right.
it. Either way, there was not a lot of opposition. You know, people have not, stood up and screamed. They've told their politicians, we don't want this. But on the other hand, other people have said to me, well, the reason there wasn't a lot of opposition at those meetings is because we raised our hands to ask questions and nobody called on us. They didn't orchestrate the meeting. They had us ask our questions afterwards. Like after they finished talking, then we were able to go into the corners and talk to the individual developers.
So it didn't have a public forum, the questions.
Exactly. So exactly. So it didn't get blown up in the newspaper as much. And I did go to one meeting where questions were raised and they weren't comfortable questions and they didn't quite have answers. They kept saying, well, we'll get back to you. How are you going to pay for the schools? We'll get back to you on that.
Mm.
So it is an interesting process. There is some democracy going on. They do have to get, like I said, get the public behind their proposal before the politicians will let it happen. And, you know, they have land. They have a right to develop it to whatever way they want. So they're trying to convince people, well, if you just tell us we can't do what we want and have some other people come in, you'll just get a little stereotypical grid development, and it'll be terrible, and there'll be even more traffic.
So what are they doing about what is public transportation like in Palm Beach County?
Not that great. It's spread out, and they have a horrible problem with this public transportation that's supposed to help, you know, the handicapped and people who really are unable to wait at a bus stop. That's been a horror story that they're trying to deal with. But buses are, you know, few and far between. And, you know, Florida, it's, you know, 90 degrees. You know, good luck finding a bus stop that you know, even gives you some shade.
We're speaking to Tony Doris. He's with the Palm Beach Post. He's been there for 10 years. He was in Miami for 14 years before that. And at the moment, we're talking about westward expansion in Palm Beach County. If you live in Miami-Dade or Broward, and if there's anything you would have done differently, what would you have done differently? What advice would you give to those who are making decisions in Palm Beach, given a chance? And Palm Beach residents, if you'd like to weigh in with your comments or questions, feel free. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. So just to stay with this for just one more moment, so they're not attempting even to move the urban development boundary. They're just going to stay within it.
Correct, so far, and that's a good thing. Although I always wonder, you know, Bonnie, just west of this particular area I was talking about are all these sugar fields.
Mm.
And, you know, for as long as sugar is profitable and the government subsidizing it, I suppose they'll stay the way they are.
Right.
Sooner or later, there's always that threat. Palm Beach County is bigger than Rhode Island, I believe, or about the same size. And so, and most of that is this land just west of the urban development boundary. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Stand by, mm-hmm. Right? So you've done enough investigative reporting in both Miami-Dade, Palm Beach counties. So let's move on to a subject that's pretty familiar to the residents of Dade and Broward County, and that would be corruption. What's it like in Palm Beach? How are the ethics in Palm Beach County?
It's problematic. You know, when I first went up there, one county commissioner after another, I think it ended up being four in total, went off to prison. A couple of city commissioners as well in West Palm Beach.
And for what?
For corruption, taking favors on things that they were voting on, taking a piece of land here, taking a hotel stay there at a luxury resort, that kind of thing. You know, you're not supposed to be voting on things when you're taking favors
right.
from folks. And, you know, it's a very old story. There was a huge outcry in the county. And as a result, they created an ethics commission. Dade was ahead of the curve here. They have
right.
a great inspector general and a great ethics commission. They put in an inspector general in Palm Beach County. But there was surprising as it was, as much as there was a public uproar for clean government, all the little municipal governments or a whole bunch of them teamed together to fight the inspector general's office. They didn't want to be, and many still don't want to be, under the oversight of an outside person that they can't control.
And what reasons do they give
publicly? The reason they gave is they didn't like the way they were supposed to contribute part of their budget to how the inspector general's office was financed. So you ended up with an inspector general who theoretically was responsible for 38 cities and towns and overseeing corruption in that many towns, and a good 14 or 15 of the towns banded together to sue to not have to pay. Over the past, I believe it's about 5 years, they still have not been able to fully staff up the inspector general's office yet. People just don't like being overseen on corruption matters. You know, there are a lot of egos involved. And again, it was shocking to me because the public was so completely behind cleaning up their government. So power to Miami-Dade and its inspector general,
right.
You know, who from the very start started doing good things.
So where does it stand now? They just, these 15 or 20 towns just refuse to ante up the money. And so it's just stalled.
It's stalled, but it's in a lawsuit, and it will be resolved. And I predict that there'll be an inspector general. We're actually, our first inspector general is now served her first, 3-4 years and is moving on. And there'll be another one that has to fight it. But as the lawsuit winds its way through the courts, hopefully, there'll be some progress. And it's something that the public can never stop pushing for, because the minute they do, their politicians will all come up with reasonable sounding rationalizations for, why we're doing just fine on our own. Thank you.
Right.
And they always say, what do you think we are, Miami-Dade,
Well,
we wish you were in some ways.
But you mentioned to me that the city of Palm Beach Gardens had never had TV coverage or any coverage of their commission meetings, and they finally acquiesced with online coverage. Why isn't that required for commission meeting, for commissions, city commissions in every town to have coverage?
It's very important for the public to be watching, or at least have the ability when you're, surfing through the channels, to stop for 5 minutes and see who's representing you and what they're saying. It's not required. In the beginning of the whole cable TV era, they were offering all these cities and towns, free or almost free equipment and their own cable channel. But that has stopped now. And so the communities, if they didn't get on the bandwagon, then have to pay for it.
And what kind of cost are we talking about?
Somewhere between $25,000 to $100,000 a year. But the irony is it's one of the poorest towns. Riviera Beach has its own TV station. A lot of stuff. West Palm Beach, which is not a wealthy town, has its own TV channel. But Palm Beach Garden is among those, and there are a number of them that still don't have any kind of TV station or broadcast. But what they did was a bunch of bad publicity during an election about transparency in government and a lot of articles written by yours truly, they finally moved to at least have online, you can stream online and watch your, you can watch them, the council meetings. Before, they had only audio, so you couldn't tell who was talking.
Right, right.
And you had to go to the city website and all that. Now you go to the city website, but you can actually watch, see who's talking, what's going on. So it's a step in the right direction.
Well, we're going to continue in that vein when we come back. We're speaking with Tony Doris, currently with the Palm Beach Post, as he has been for the last 10 years. And he's written his first novel. It's called Dirt, which we're going to talk about. And we'll take your calls and your emails. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, and we're visiting with Tony Doris. He's an editor, columnist, investigative reporter, and a novelist as well. He's been with the Palm Beach Post for the last 10 years. He's been with the Miami Daily Business Review, the St. Petersburg Times, among other newspapers, and his first novel is Dirt. And we're talking about corruption, but we're going to stay with that. But first, let's talk to Omar, because he's been waiting, and I think he wants to talk about public transportation. Hi, Omar. Welcome. Hi.
I just want to say, first of all, I'm a longtime listener. It's my third time calling in, third time on the air. I really like your program in relation to South Florida's affair and what's going on here. My question for your person that you have is that I'm in my mid-20s, and my friends, we go to Los Solis, where nightlife is. We go to always on the East Coast towards the ocean is where main events happen. However, Tri-Rail is on the west side of 95. And since you're a reporter for the Miami Herald and now you're a reporter in Palm Beach, why is it that it's kept on the west side of 95 and not moved to the east side? Because I would love to take Tri-Rail and not have to worry about my car.
It's not all the way west. I think it's just where it is because historically that's where the tracks were built. But there are some efforts right now underway to bring a local train line down to the easternmost rail. I'm not an expert on this topic by any stretch, but you're really right. I mean, it's really hard to take a train once you get off the train. There's no way to get to where you need to go. And I think regional planners are aware of the issue. You know, it could be 5 or 10 years off before something happens. But there, like I said, there is this effort to stretch the rail lines and make them the ones that go closer to the coast be the ones that carry people instead of just freight.
Right, right. Well, I hope to see that in my lifetime.
Yeah, me
if
too.
If it happens. But going along with this, it's development that you're talking about that might happen in the west side of the Palm Beach area. If any of the Palm Beach representatives that are listening, they really need to look at what are the concerns in Broward and Miami and see how they can improve West Palm Beach, and that'll help West Palm Beach grow in the future even more.
I agree.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Omar, thanks for calling. And I guess in connection with that, All Aboard Florida in Palm Beach County, are you familiar with what's going on with that?
Yeah, I've been following it from a distance, but it's moving along. There's a lot of there are a lot of objections to it because a lot of people wonder why they would want to go to Orlando from West Palm Beach. There's not necessarily that much demand, but a lot of people afford. There are a lot of concerns about noise going through local communities and stops and horns and all that stuff. It's very much up for debate right now.
Yeah, it's concerning here as well. Towns here that it's going to go through. Okay, well, I want to get back to the novel. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
On your first novel. And it's set in Miami, and you say it's loosely based on your years here covering the government. So can you tell us about some juicy events that inspired the book?
Well, when I set out, I was a reporter for the Miami Daily Business Review, not the Herald. And as doing that for 10, 14 years, whatever it was, I just came across so many things. I mean, I learned how to be an investigative reporter just from watching things that I couldn't believe were right before my eyes in this town. And so when I decided I wanted it, it's finally time to write my book. I'm 100 years old. I better get going. I just made a list of all these horror stories that I'd seen, some of which I had proven and written about, some of which people had talked to me about, but you could never get anyone to talk on the record. So, they just went in the back of my head appeared in fictionalized form now in the book. But there were things when I was reporting here, the county commissioners would wait until the end of the meeting when everybody was gone home, and then the last
take the vote.
I still see that happening. In fact, in Palm Beach Gardens, I've now got them well behaved. I got to say they're now being very conscious about doing important issues early in the meeting. But things in Miami-Dade during my time here would get snuck in at the end. There were things like, two city departments, each of which, because of the work that they do, needed paving work on the streets. And so one would buy, say, a ton of asphalt for $25 a ton, and the other department, strangely, would be paying $75 to $85 for the same asphalt for the same kind of work. How did that happen? So, all that kind of thing got combined into this book. And one of the things you talk about, transparency in government, well, there's some things that backfire. There's a thing called the cone of silence, where when people are going to be voting on a certain topic, they're supposed to not discuss it with their fellow commissioners. No one's supposed to talk to the county staffers who are working on it because it's supposed to be a clean vote. Well, so one of the premises of the book is, well, what happens if, because nobody's talking to anybody else, something can get on the agenda that nobody knows who put it there or why, and then mysteriously it just gets voted on and passes? But these kinds of things, well, I won't say they happen, but they happen in my book anyway.
Okay. And what else?
Well, one of my favorite things in Miami-Dade County is called the emergency appropriation. You have to put things out to bid, major multi-million dollar contracts all the time, big procedures. It takes months to draw up the specifications, put out the bids, wait for the bids to come back, select them, selection committees. Well, sometimes if you're buying asphalt for, millions of dollars more than you should be paying for it, you run out of the money that's been allotted for it. But you have roads that need to be paved, so you need to do an emergency appropriation. And when you call it an emergency appropriation, you don't need to go through all the bidding procedures. So you just give it to your friend.
Okay. So that's part of what's
all,
in the book.
It's all mixed there in the book. And the other thing is, and this is...
But you have a daughter... father-daughter
Yeah.
Relationship in there,
the
too.
Premise, the book starts with, you know, there's a tired old journalist who's a columnist working at the Miami newspaper. And his college daughter decides to spend a summer with an internship at the newspaper doing all the scut work. And she stumbles across some of this stuff that all the other reporters have been walking past. It's kind of how I, you know, learned a lot about investigative reporting, you know, things that the Herald would be tired of or wouldn't have time for. I said, what's going on here? And well, anyway, so she's this little intern at the newspaper, and she starts stumbling across stuff, and she gets her father, the old tired columnist, to come out of his cocoon and work on it with her. Since he's actually quite a good journalist. And the two, you know, as it unfolds, kind of solve the great mystery of what's going on, these things getting on the agenda that nobody lays claim to. Right, that nobody knew about. And they solve it. So they kind of repair their own lives while they're repairing Miami's. And what they're coming across in the book is someone is redesigning all of downtown Miami. The whole block by block, the city is being changed.
And, oh, sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah, kind of familiar. How did that happen? You know, so that's the gist of it. It's all these scandals that I put together, along with you know, the running theme of the relationship between the father and the daughter. And it's funny because my own daughter is 18 now, but when I first started, and she started reading the book, you know, try getting your kids to read your book. She started reading it recently, and she said, "Oh, that girl really sounds like me." And I said, "Yeah, but when I was writing this book for it first, you were only 8 years old, so
it was a little ahead of time,
right?"
And you did say to me before the show that you wish you were your daughter, who's traveling in France right now.
Right, yeah, right. She's got the best life.
Okay, let's take a call before we go to a break. It's back about transportation. It's Michael. Hi, Michael, in Delray.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm a newcomer from New York, and there are meetings held on a monthly basis, a Citizens Advisory Council to the Metropolitan Transit Association, the MTA, that governs the region, both the subway system as well as the two suburban feeder lines in Long Island and upstate, Metro North Line. And all kind of issues are brought up, and guests from various aspects and departments of those train lines and bus lines as well appear and answer questions. So there's accountability. It's a body that only serves as an advisory capacity. So they can't, you know, force, legislate. But what movement is there toward that entity? Is it already that exists here? I've had problems with PalmTrans drivers that aren't paying attention to your request to let you off at a certain stop, or are rude, or just totally ignore what rudeness is going on in the bus from one passenger to another. And this board, when it was supposed to meet in December, so I could bring some of these problems that I've had up and hear about other issues that were on the agenda, they didn't meet on December because it was the day after Christmas. So they didn't want to. They wanted a long holiday weekend. Remember, Christmas was on Wednesday of last year. This was the advisory board to the PalmTrans bus system.
Okay.
So that does exist, but that's just the PalmTrans bus system. You know, to what degree do they interface with other train and bus systems, especially when it comes to coordination of schedules, so that you don't just miss your train at Tri-Rail by a minute after you've taken the PalmTrans bus to the station, or vice versa.
Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is it's all very political. It's like you got to go up the ladder. If that advisory board isn't responding to legitimate questions like that, then the only thing you can do is go to your county commissioner, go to your city commissioner, because those are the ones who appoint the advisory boards.
Uh-huh.
It's New York. I grew up partly on Long Island myself, so I can tell you they're far more advanced than we are in mass transportation. But part of it is because they're older communities that have had a longer time to do it, and they were well planned to begin with. Florida's, you know,
just getting its train wheels and bus wheels wet. so to speak, to mix a metaphor. But the good thing about the bus system here that New York doesn't have is the bike rack on the front of the bus that enables bike riders to, you know, hitch a ride on the bus and then take the bike off and continue on their way. And we don't have that in New York yet. So, you know, I don't want to paint a totally negative picture.
Okay. Thanks, Michael, for calling.
Sure.
Okay. We're speaking with Tony Doris, editor, columnist, investigative reporter, journalist, and novelist. Dirt, available at Amazon, right?
Right. So Amazon, okay. Nook, iPod.
Your local independent bookstore.
There you go.
Okay. Let's take a break on today's topical currents. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Tony Doris, veteran journalist and with the Palm Beach Post now in his 10th year. And we're talking about, well, a variety of things. We have Angela, though, we're going to talk to next in Pompano Beach.
Hi.
Hi, Angela. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm very interested in the topic today. So my name is Angela Hill. I'm running for Pompano Beach City Commissioner, District 1. I just threw my hat in the ring.
Good luck.
Thank you. My question was regarding term limits, because I know West Palm Beach was just successful at getting term limits for their city commissioners, mm-hmm. and that's one of the platforms I'm running on. And it's a unique situation in Pompano Beach. Actually, all five districts are up for election November 4th.
Oh,
and we have three city commissioners who've been there for quite some time who are retiring. So it's going to be a whole new influx, hopefully, of new commissioners with fresh blood in there. So I just was asking for some advice.
Well, you know, the town that I cover most commonly now, Palm Beach Gardens, is going through a battle right now where they've got people, you know, one guy's in there 20 years, one guy's been a city mm-hmm. councilman for 26 years. And I think term limits are a good thing. The debate is over how long should they be limited. I mean, and the argument is, well, 8 years is enough for president. Well, you know, why do you need, 20 years? And the argument on the other side is, it's your experienced mm. commissioners who understand the complexities of running a government, getting things accomplished. But you have a unique situation there with all five people up for election at once. Usually the elections are staggered. So it sounds like people in Pompano Beach get a chance to do a sea change if that's what they need.
It's looking that way. In fact, the current sitting commissioner that I'm running against and I met for coffee, and he was trying to convince me all the reasons why I should not run because he ran unopposed the last two times. So mm-hmm. I told him I was committed to, I'm in it to win it, but I'll definitely be supportive if I don't. So thank you for your input. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
And my website's angelahill.us.
Mm-hmm. All right, Angela. Thanks for calling. Good
thank
luck.
You. Have a great day.
Good luck.
Thanks.
And if you do want to talk to Tony Doris about, well, that's up to you. If you're in Palm Beach County or Miami-Dade and Broward, if you remember Tony or want to give a little advice for how things should be done in Palm Beach County as they encounter some of the same issues that Miami-Dade and Broward have, call us 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Pam in Boca, welcome.
Hi, I just tuned in, so I'm not sure if this covers my topic. But I live in Palm Beach County, and we're concerned because several developers now are trying to develop golf courses throughout Palm Beach County. And the homeowners are, of course, outraged about this because our property values will go down. And we paid a premium price for golf course views, and now they're going to build right outside our doors, somewhere, 25 feet from our backyards. So a group of people have consistently gone up to the Palm Beach County Commissioners three times. We've done this. A huge group of people have spoken against this development, but yet the commissioners still want us to compromise and let the developers build a large number of homes on these golf courses. So I just wondered what your opinion about this is and how we can fight it.
Hmm. It's a tough issue, and you're not alone. I think there are three or four places in Palm Beach County, a bunch of them in Boca, where you're not talking about developing a golf course, you're talking about using an old golf course and developing on it. And the problem is that there are, you know, as demographics change, you know, from what I've heard, fewer people are golfing, and so you're left with fewer people to support, you know, the golf courses that exist. So what do you do with them? You know, does everybody get hit with a huge assessment in the community to pay for upkeep for a golf course that nobody uses? So it's a hard compromise to find. I mean, the squeaky wheel will get the grease. You know, the louder the voice to your commissioners is the one that will be listened to. That's all I can tell you. You know, it's a hard call.
Well, the past court cases have ruled against this because they say it will actually ruin our neighborhoods. There'll be urban sprawl, run amok. There'll be increase in traffic, but yet the county commissioners are so biased, it seems to us, that they want to give these contracts to these developers and develop this land. It just seems like there's something in it for them to develop the land and go totally against the citizens of Palm Beach County.
I hear you. And like I said, the louder your voice, the more you'll be listened to. That's how it works.
Yeah, well, I understand that. But, you know, we've gone up there three times, and it's just been unbelievable turnout of citizens that have gone up and spoken to the commissioners. And we've spoken loud and clear. We've had attorneys. We've hired all kinds of land use experts. And still, they want to develop this land.
Right. Sounds like you're doing what you can. It's a long, hard fight. You have my sympathy.
Yeah. Thank you, Pam.
Great.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's move on to Javier in Hillsborough Beach. Javier has a question about term limits. Hi, Javier. Welcome.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
My name's Javier Garcia. I'm actually the vice mayor of Hillsborough Beach. And I guess I've kind of been involved in the process down here for a little bit. But just talking about term limits, I think it's super important, and I feel that we've kind of lost touch on it. What I've seen just being inside the process is that you've got professional politicians down here in South Florida, and they found a way to just continually stay elected. And I feel that if anything, what we need to do is really push, you know, let's say, if you want to run for public office, run, but then also have a commitment that you're not going to just jump from this seat to the next seat, and you're not going to jump from the next seat to the next seat. And before you know it, you know, you kind of get addicted to this game of power, in my opinion. So I'm just very open. I run a very open, you know, dialogue with my constituents, and I let them know, you know, what my goals are and stuff, but I don't see it the same. And it goes across parties as well. And I'm sure the reporter right now, I'm sure he can kind of touch on what he's seen as well, but just from being in the process for almost the last 4 years, that's all I've seen is just it's like the Hunger Games in a sense.
Okay, Tony, Doris?
Well, you know, I've seen both sides of it. I've seen commissioners who've been in office for a long time who were really good and did know the highly technical issues that go along with things like growth management and transportation, and I've seen others who are just, you know, carved the rules around themselves in such a way that they could never get booted out of office. So, you know, it depends on the individual. And, you know, I've also seen politicians who use lower office, that's how it works, to work their way up to be a congresswoman. And sometimes that's a good thing. So, you know, term limits are fine if they're, you know, handled in the right way. And if people of a community agree together on how long those limits should be.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I just can't see anyone being in a political position for over 20 years and then still have good ideas, to be honest with you. So I think at one point you just kind of you run out of ideas and then you circled yourself around a bunch of people that are telling you what you're doing is a good idea when obviously it's just benefiting them. So.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Javier.
No problem. I just wanted to add one comment was you guys had talked about All Aboard Florida and the real concern being that there would be a train via Dade County all the way up to Orlando, and that would be what would be making the noise. But to be honest with you, what I see as being the, you know, the noisemaker is going to be the freight side. And I think that in South Florida, we need to have a conversation to decide why are we still running freight on the old rails when we could possibly you know, look at an expansion. Let's say, for example, there's a corridor on the side of 595 that could easily run a rail, and then you run it up along north on 27. And so we need to stop, you know, I guess, building and designing our transportation infrastructure off of, you know, our forefathers and start building and designing for the future. Because if South Florida has any chance of competing in an international marketplace, we need to change the way we definitely run our, I guess, our logistics.
Good points, and those conversations are being had, you know.
Yep, for sure. Well, I just wanted to plant the seed there, so hopefully our listeners in South Florida will start, you know, coming up with some ideas and then bringing it back to their local elected officials. And I think the best thing that anyone can do, especially we live in this country, is that you run for public office, even if you lose. At least you're standing up there and you're taking a chance.
Okay, Javier, thanks so much for calling.
Have a wonderful day.
You Bye-bye. Too. And we're going to take a break on today's Topical Kerns, speaking with Palm Beach Post journalist Tony Doris, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Kerns, Bonnie Berman and Tony Doris, editor and columnist, investigative reporter, novelist, and currently with the Palm Beach Post, as he has been for the last 10 years. We have lots to cover, Tony. I wanted to, you know, here we are at the
Let's
start
Let's make
of,
it a two-hour show.
That's a good idea. Hurricane season has begun. So what measures are being taken after the havoc wreaked by Tropical Storm Isaac?
Yeah, well, Isaac was a good wake-up call because a lot of people think of hurricanes as windstorms. But a lot of times the hurricane just stops and sits where it is and pours rain on top of you. And most of the damage, if I remember right, from Isaac was just tons and
flooding.
Tons of rain and flooding. And I know Palm Beach Gardens, for example, spent $5 million and they dredged out every canal they had so that there's somewhere for the water to go. Some dikes were fortified all over the county. There's a lot more concern these days, and that's a good thing, about how to handle the drainage and clear out canals of brush and overgrowth that, you know, a tree on the edge can fall over and block all the drainage. And oh my God, we had a place in West Palm Beach during one of the storms where it just took a couple of guys who forgot to turn a switch on one of the canals, and the water blocked everything up. And people, I think, throughout South Florida are a lot more cognizant, thanks to Isaac, of the danger of flooding, and have been doing a lot of things over the years. And this is the time of season, by the way, when all your communities are doing their hurricane preparation drills, and that certainly figures into them all.
So a lot has been done since Isaac
for
the drainage problems.
I guess.
What about the flooding in January? I know it wasn't in Palm Beach Gardens, but it was in Boynton and Del Rey. And I believe a couple of people, maybe three people, died from those floods.
It's a terrible thing. I mean, it catches you completely by surprise to suddenly see your normal street with cars floating down it. You can bet the people in those municipalities have been figuring it out what to do. I mean, it's a combination of the South Florida Water Management District that controls the locks and the canals and whatnot, and local communities themselves. It's a big project. That Florida is prone to that kind of rainfall. People from up north don't realize it. But it never seems to drizzle here in Florida. We only get downpours.
But it's so surprising that anyone in South Florida would be unprepared, any municipality, because we do get those torrential rains. Mm. I mean, here we are in, you know, this subtropical climate.
I guess that's true. But you know what? We haven't had a major hurricane in a while either. I mean, so the people are working real hard at it. I can tell you, these municipal officials, everyone that I have ever... city I've ever covered, take this job very seriously.
Right.
But it's hard. There's always something that catches you unawares.
Did you mention to me that you were at the FEMA meeting recently?
I was at one in Palm Beach Gardens where they were. They have their own, 200-mile-an-hour proof emergency operations center. And the drill consisted of having, 24 different people who were in charge of the whole city coordinate and go through a fake hurricane, simulated hurricane, mm-hmm. and talk about what they would do, how they would communicate, what gets handled first, the debris or the flooding, and how do they do it. And it's similar things that take place throughout South Florida. It's a really necessary part and an often unseen part by the public of preparing for hurricanes.
Let's see. Who's been waiting? Steve in Delray Beach has been waiting. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Topical Currents.
Thanks. My question concerns the Tri-Rail and the non-link to Fort Lauderdale International and to Palm Beach International. It seems to me they spent gazillion dollars in interminable years redoing 95, which is falling apart in Palm Beach County already. But at any rate, why did they not put a direct link from Tri-Rail right to the airport? I mean, every European city that I've ever been in, regardless of where the airport was, had a rail line that went directly to the terminals.
I can only tell you that you're right. You know, one of the things in my experience was when I was reporting in Miami, I was taking the Metro Rail every day to work in downtown. 14 minutes from where I was in South Miami to downtown, another 5 minutes on the People Mover for free. Everything connected with everything. It was the greatest.
And now it goes to the airport.
And so, you know, it's a perfect example of how it works and how it should work. Those connections are the most important part. It doesn't help to have a train going, you know, 150 miles if you can't connect. I said this earlier in the show with where you want to be when you get there. And it's one of the things, like in Miami-Dade, for example, it's appalling that there's no train out, you know, Kendall Drive after all these years. And people spend an hour and a half in the morning driving 8 miles to get into downtown. So your comment about connecting with the airports and connecting with everything else, very important. And in some ways, Miami-Dade is ahead of the curve. In some ways, they've let things go.
Could I ask you, since you're a reporter and you report on these sort of things, I was told when I asked this question of my representative, he said, off the record, the reason we don't have that is because the taxi companies and the bus lines lobbied against having any Tri-Rail connection to the airports. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, to the extent that, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, if there's a concentrated group of cab companies that's putting money into campaign contributions and there's this amorphous group of people like you and me who don't make our voices heard in any way, then yeah, the cab company's voice would get heard more. I don't believe in a big conspiracy theory, and I strongly believe, I've seen it over and over again, that if you make your position known in big numbers, your politicians will jump.
Okay, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, Tony, you've seen so many changes in the world of journalism, newspapers. Tell us what you've seen, what changes, and where do you think things are going to be going?
Well, in journalism, I tell you right now, everybody is focused on nothing but digital, digital, digital. How do we... As in Palm Beach County, we're privileged because we have a base of older readers who love their newspaper, like I do, who feel only comfortable with that newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so we still have 100,000 people reading a newspaper every day. But as we see time goes on, the numbers are changing. And what's really troubling is that, you know, nobody under 35 reads a newspaper anymore. But how do they get the news? You know, do they get it in little tidbits here and there,
right,
digitally? And will we have a society that completely doesn't know the important things that are going on? As somebody who covers corruption, I know that the minute the public stops looking, the cockroaches come out from every corner. And so it remains to be seen what happens with our future generations, how well informed they keep themselves. But at newspapers, we're looking for what balance? What is it that we can do to make younger readers and listeners and clickers pay attention to what's going on in their community? You know, and some of it is outright pandering, giving them what they want, and some of them is trying to figure out different formats, you know, shorter stories, more visually laid out things online to make them attracted to, you know, what we think they should know about. You know, it's kind of like politics. You know, to some extent, you give people what they want. To some extent, you've got to just lead them and show them what's important to them. And that's the balance that we're fighting for now. We are seeing in newspapers, as the print subscriptions recede slowly, we are seeing the digital subscriptions pick up and people listening more. But it's all very experimental at this point.
When I went to your column, I mean, in order to read more, I had to subscribe.
Yes.
I mean, I could read so much, but then I had to subscribe.
There's a paywall. We have actually have different sites. We have two different websites. We have a free website where you get mostly things like, you know, breaking news and police crimes and the booking blotter and stuff. And then we have the paid site, which is more detailed material. And so you can go on the free site, but then you have, if you want to see a story in more depth, you got to click and subscribe to get the real story. You know, we're hoping that people will see value in that, just as they used to see value in subscribing to newspapers.
Yeah, so they can stay afloat.
Well, it's hard breaking habits, you know, now that we've given it away on the internet for free for so long.
Exactly.
It's hard building that back up for people to see the value in it.
Okay, so let's talk about your life a little bit, because I mentioned you were paid in breadfruit.
Okay.
Breadfruit when you reported in Tahiti, but just you grew up in Brussels and New York.
Yeah, well, I grew up partly in Long Island and Massachusetts, and you know, after sixth grade, my dad took a job doing retail department store consulting in Europe, and so we lived in Brussels for a few years, and it's good, gave me a chance to travel all over and, you know, learn French and. Now, I eventually moved back and finished school in the States, and I was well into my career when I decided one day that I needed to have another adventure. I remembered what it was like to see the whole rest of the world, and here I was about to turn 30, and, you know, I know that I was going to get locked into a house in a suburban life, so I better do something. So I put on a backpack, left a perfectly good job at the St. Pete Times, and traveled around the world, and ended up with a job in Tahiti with a big breadfruit tree right in front of the window.
Breadfruit. Okay, well, and being paid in that. So how did it taste? It was pretty good.
It tastes kind of like peanut butter and pineapple put together. I could do without it. But
well, yeah. And it. Just one more question. Is Palm Beach County glad or sad to lose the National Enquirer? I see they moved back to New York.
Yeah, well, we like our jobs in Palm Beach County, but, you know, always sad to see them go. What can I say? We're happy. Maybe more people can subscribe to the Palm Beach Post instead of the Enquirer now.
There we go. Well, Tony Doris, he's an editor, columnist, investigative reporter, and novelist as well. He's with the Palm Beach Post, has been for the last 10 years, and has been with several other publications, including the Miami Daily Business Review, when he used to have a stint on WLRN, and was a regular contributor, actually, on Topical Currents.
With Joe Cooper.
With Joe Cooper, who we wish so well. And his first novel is called Dirt. And for more information, you can go to his website. It's just tonydoris.com. Tony, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Really been a pleasure. And that is our program for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and production assistance from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, and links to today's show and all our shows at WLRN.org, and at our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents looks at the history of soccer as the 2014 FIFA World Cup gets underway in Brazil on Thursday. We have guest host Andy Wagner and our resident soccer expert and enthusiast, who will speak with Joshua Nadal about his book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. And Bonnie Berman, thanking you so much and sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper for a speedy recovery. Hoping you have a great day. Thank you, Tony Doris, so much. And please stay tuned for Here and Now. Up next from NPR News.